Welcome to Aspire. I'm your host, Gregory Pan. This program, this satsang, is for Saturday, September the 19th, 2015. And I'm very grateful that you chose to be with me. I'm very, very grateful. These programs, these satsangs, questions and answers that so many of you put to me after listening to radio programs or maybe watching one of my TV programs, of which I'm deeply humbled that you take the time to do, I get these marvelous questions, and I am grateful. They're intelligent. They're typically on the money. Sometimes they're a little challenging, but they are always well worth it, more than well worth it. So I am grateful for all of you who take the time to ask a question. I really do. Most people don't, they don't even know what to ask. So this is really a wonderful thing for me. These programs are produced, and you are listening to them because of the generosity and the kindness of my Aspire sponsors. It is only through their sponsorship that you are able to listen to these offerings. I hope that you will become a sponsor and that you will help us sustain these programs that are so vital and very important to so many. And you can do that through the website here at aspire.org. You'll see sponsorship. Choose a program that works for you. Click on it. Make it happen. Do something really generous. Our mystery donor is matching. Yes, he is. All year-end gifts and sponsorship. So if you become a sponsor, let's say you do $25 a month, he will match that and make it $50. Very nice man, and this is a wonderful time to become a sponsor. Let us get to the questions. I wanted a theme for today, so I sat down and muscled through a lot of questions that people have put to me. I get on the average per week of 30 questions a week, maybe a little bit more. And some of the questions are questions I can answer on radio. Some of them are, I can't use that language here. So anyway, I don't. But a lot of them have to do with meditation, etc., and living a life that is more spiritual. Although most people, the millennials, are not too much interested in that, nor are the X generation. So a lot of them come, I think, from people, this is a Greg Penn guess, in their 50s. So I weeded out and found three wonderful questions about making meditation a lifestyle, which it should be. It's not something you do. It is a lifestyle. And that's what these questions are all about. First one comes from Sandy in Westwood, California. She says, how does one make meditation a lifestyle, as you talk about so often? I don't see how that is possible. Sandy, it is possible. Is it probable? No. But possible? Yes. It can be done. Any of us can do it. And I'll tell you what a lifestyle of meditation is all about, and how do you make your home an ashram? One of the first things you have to do is you have to be practicing meditation. If you are not practicing meditation, then of course nothing can be a lifestyle. Nothing can be congruent to making a lifestyle where you are living in the course of your heart rather than in your head. So if you're not a meditator, then you won't understand a single word I'm saying. Some of the things that we do in our lifestyle, besides have regular times for meditation. You know how people have regular times for TV or whatever it is that they call a pastime, which I don't know how anyone can just sit there and do something as a pastime. I remember when baseball was America's pastime. What does that mean? Just frivolously use my life and watch TV, watch a baseball with Sherman? Is that what we're talking about? Just sitting there. Sherman loves baseball. It's his mundane mind sitting there Analyzing baseball. Is that what it's all about? Now, I watch football, but I don't watch gobs of it. And I can't watch gobs of it because it takes up too much of my precious time to meditate and to do the things I need to do. So, a game maybe once a week, maybe, that's good. Maybe a Saturday or a Sunday afternoon. But to make it an everyday thing or something we do, like TV watching our soaps or whatever it is you watch on a continual basis, I don't think so. So here's what you got to do. You got to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. So you have housework to do. I have housework to do. Every morning after I get up and I do some work in the office, starting at about 3 a.m., I go upstairs and I vacuum my home. I dust it. I clean the bathrooms for my students who will be coming. I make my bed. I clean the kitchen. I get dressed. And I do this all mindfully. I am grateful for everything I do. I watch the way I make the bed. I watch how the mind works as it thinks it's being mundane by making a bed or vacuuming the house or cleaning a toilet or cleaning the kitchen and making it clean. Not spotless, just clean. I watch my mind. What is it doing? What is it proposing? What kind of ideas does it have about, this is mundane and I don't want to do this every day. Your whole life is just about cleaning. I don't do that. My mind does not do that. It probably would love to do that. I can imagine that. But I don't go there with it. I'm in this particular activity totally and completely. I chop wood. I carry water. And chopping wood and carrying water from the well consciously, not thinking about what I have to do in the day or what's next after I do all this. I am just there cleaning, making the bed, and making my house presentable for my students to come and work upon themselves here. That is it. That's how you make meditation a lifestyle. I also have a place in my home, like most people would have a dining room, or a bedroom, or a child's room, or a TV room, a room for meditation. Now, a lot of people, a room for meditation? You waste that? There is one room that I have in my office. It is just a little showman that I have. It is where I meditate. My master's robe hangs there. I sit quietly. I meditate every single day. This room, no computer is on. Nothing is turned on. The ambient tones are in the background. I simply meditate here. This is my room for meditation. And when I am done, then I can turn on the computers and go to work. But when the afternoon comes and I'm going to meditate again, I turn off everything and I just sit in the quietness of this room. That's making meditation a lifestyle. Then as I prepare my breakfast or I eat my lunch, I sit quietly, not reading, not watching TV, not doing anything, watching how I eat. And sometimes I will eat in front of a mirror just to see what that looks like and what is going on. And I often see a lot there. So I eat quietly. I just simply eat, not wanting to think about how good the food tastes and where it came from or I want more, not that. Just quietly eating. Eating without desire, I found, makes the food a different thing. Eating without wanting more food makes eating different as well. Just eating. Then when I'm done, I go back down and finish my day, whatever it may be, counseling or whatever. In the evening, I come back down here, everything is turned off, and I meditate one last time. Now, in all of this, in the background, is the ambient tones that I play. I have tones for going to sleep. I have tones for during the day. And they run 24/7 in my home. I don't use my home as a place to flop. I use my home as a way to proportion myself, to meditate, to sustain meditation. My home is the posture of my meditation. It is not solemn. I have a TV. I can watch football if I want on Sundays. I can watch a movie if I want, but I never watch movies much during the week. I don't sit there and watch a two-hour movie. I don't have time for it. So it just doesn't play. I eat, I sleep, I work, I meditate. I keep it as simple as possible. I keep my home as clean as possible. And I want a simple life. I don't want more than what is. I don't need to travel. I don't need to have more people in my life. I enjoy my students and I love them dearly. And we get together from time to time and we have wonderful times together eating very healthy home-cooked food and just enjoying the beauty of each other. But I do not use these social times as a time of looking at my life and going, wow, this is what it's all about. You know, I got to have all this social time. So there you are, Sandy. It's cost me a wife or two. They don't like this. Women generally have to be entertained a lot and have a lot of stimulation. But I find that this lifestyle is conducive to my practice. And I never wake up in the morning thinking, oh, another day. I look forward to waking up. I look forward to going to work. I look forward to being with my students in a certain kind of way. Not like, you know, anticipation. I am blessed. I am grateful. And I know what's going on. And oftentimes things are revealed to me during the cleaning and the making of the bed and the eating and all of that stuff that help me serve my students better. And that's what it's all about for me. Sandy, you got to find your own style in this. But first, you have to meditate. And I don't know if you do. I don't know. It isn't about going to your local Zen store and buying a few rocks and a waterfall. It's about many other things. I hope that helps you. Thank you for your question, Sandy. Please forgive me. Namaste. That's a great question. I went on too much. I'm sorry. The next one comes from Teddy. He does not tell me where he lives. How does one live with a non-meditator in a meditative lifestyle, Teddy? It is very difficult to live. I tried with women to live with a non-meditator. All of my beloveds did not meditate, none of them. They were not meditators. They didn't care to meditate. And you'd ask me why I got involved. It's a long story. I'm not going to go there right now. It's not that I'm hiding anything. It's just a long story. It all boils down to it's pretty difficult. And I watch a lot of my female students. They drag their husbands to me, a lot of them. They'll drag their, this is when I was teaching formally, and it even happens now from time to time. They'll drag their husband in, you know. Oh, I found this great pen guy, and he can help us meditate, and we can learn from him. And what she has is a hope that maybe through meditation, he'll straighten out in some way, or he'll become a better person, you know, by doing whatever it is that she thinks is meditative. So what happens here is she drags him in, and he doesn't really want to meditate. He's just, all right, whatever. You know, he's happy life, happy wife kind of guy. 99% of these guys are. And so they hang in there for a while until they just, the woman just realizes, you know, this whole thing isn't getting me what I want. This just isn't working for me. I love that when women do that. This just isn't working for me. Working for you? So, of course, by then he's starting to get a little more mindful and in a rhythm. And so the rhythm is kind of going and going and going. And he's ever so slightly on the verge of starting to understand the nature of meditation, etc. But she pulls him out because this isn't working for me. He isn't the one. We need another kind of teacher. And the best kind of teacher is a dead one, a teacher who's dead, a master who's dead, or a teacher who's teaching you about something that doesn't exist, like now. There is no now. Life belongs to impermanence. Impermanence is timeless. So there is no now moment. So she's always looking for someone who is going to appease her emotional nature. She pulls him. He goes, of course, because you can't get a divorce over this. This would be ridiculous. And that's the end of that. It is very difficult to practice living in meditation when your spouse or your beloved is not into it. It's very rare that it can last very long. The practice, that is. So typically, it doesn't. It just doesn't last long. And, of course, you go your merry way, living a life that you live when nothing's been accomplished. Meaning of your life has not been accomplished. The life you are living has not been accomplished or set forth in a meaningful way, and you just live that pedestrian mentality out. And that's what most people do. It's just survival. For most people, it's just survival. 99 and 9 tenths is just survival. It has nothing to do with finding substance to your living. It's about, will your philosophy get me what I want? Will I be able through meditation to get more money, travel, and have all the things I want? A stellar life, as one of my students put it. Really? No. Time to go. Time to go. So it is very difficult, Teddy. I don't know if you're really planning on meditating or you already do meditate and you're finding resistance. Pretty soon through meditation, you start seeing through the veneer of everybody and everything, including yourself. And you start realizing, I have not been true to my heart. I need to replenish my spirit. I need to do things that allow my inner spirit to grow. And that means maybe coming to a retreat or two or three and getting in a consistent flow. Of course, she's going to go, look, I don't want money spent on that. I want to travel. I want to go to Europe. I want to go here. I want to go there. I want to have fun. I don't want you spending our money on meditation. It's ridiculous. It doesn't get you anything. And there you go. It's a goner. And that makes sense to the pedestrian mentality. That's why the world is the way the world is, on the brink of war and hate and fear. All of us are a part of that. We're not making much progress here. So this just continues on and on and on to oblivion, and most people don't get it, and they live by the sheer fact of what pleasures them. They never mature, and that's the end of that. So, Teddy, the word I'm looking for, impossible. Now, if you are married to a woman who loves you, which would be really rare, that would mean that she would let you do whatever you need to do in order to sustain your inner growth, because she would realize that the man she loves is the inner man, not the outer man. And if she loves the inner man that brought her into this life with compassion and love, she would let you do whatever you need to do in order to mature. But I guarantee you 100% that that didn't happen here. Or you wouldn't be asking me this question, would you? Please forgive me. Namaste. I guess you can see why I'm so popular. Yeah. Oh, Greggy, he just doesn't know when to shut his mouth. The last question comes from, let's see, Leslie. She doesn't tell me where she lives, forgive me. Please tell me the story of the monk and the master and the box. I remember you telling this way back in the 90s. Way back? Well, I guess it is. Okay, here's the story. And I remember Leslie. She loved this story. It is a great story. It is about a master who had a student, and he was going to leave that student for a few months. And he said to the student, he had been his meditation teacher and his teacher. He said to the student, "I am leaving for 3 months and I will be back. I want you to continue your practice, but I am leaving you this box. And I want you to put it in the southeast corner of your home and just let it sit there until I return." Well, the monk thought nothing of it. "Well, no problem. I can do this." So he put the box where the master told him to, which was in his bedroom. And all of a sudden, because he was a good student, a student, shall we say, of looking at life from a point of view of how things fit. He was really looking at it from the point of view of its cognate, you know, qualities, intrinsic qualities. He realized that he had to make the room fit the box, that the box was in the wrong place. And hence, it made the room in the wrong place. So rather than moving the box, he moved the room around the box. He understood what it all meant. So he moved his bed. He moved his dressers. He saw that the room, when he did that, needed painting. So he painted it. He saw the geometry of it. Well, now the bedroom fit the box. But now the bedroom didn't fit the rest of the house. It looked odd. So he went and he fixed the front room, the kitchen, his dining room, all to fit the bedroom. And he got it all done. Then everything in the house was starting to fit together. The feng shui of it, as it were. But now the outside of the house didn't fit the inside of the house. So he had to go and remodel a little bit of the outside, repair it, paint it. Then the garden didn't fit the house. So the bedroom, the interior of the house, the exterior, all of that was in sync with the box. But now the garden needed to be changed. So he changed the garden. And while he was working out there one day, oh, his master shows up. And his master looks at everything and smiles. And the monk said to the master, "Ever since you've been gone, I've been working harder than ever, trying to make everything fit that box. And now that I have it all fitting and everything," he said, "I have to know what's inside that box. I have been on nothing but work since you left." And the master looked at him and smiled with a great smile and said, "Emptiness." There you go, Leslie. If you make your home your ashram, you'll make it fit the emptiness of your heart, which is filled with love and kindness, instead of just haphazardly making a house. You have to be interested in the intrinsic that lives within you. Symmetry is everything. And the monk made the house fit the symmetry of the box. And that's what it's all about, symmetry. Meditation is about a certain form of symmetry. If you're going to make it a lifestyle, you place it in one aspect of your life. and then you build your life around it. What is interesting is for people to see, my students hate it when I ask them this question. They just freaking hate it. What are you building your life around? They don't want to admit money, pleasure, travel, all sorts of things, anything that isn't spiritual. Which leads me back to a statement that Mary Magdalene made so many thousands of years ago. The reason you get sick and die is because you love what misleads you. And that is a hard one to overcome. Leslie, thank you for your beautiful question. If you have a comment or question or something I might be of service to you in, you know where to go. Top of the page here, it says contact. Just hit it. Send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. I would be honored. Have a beautiful day. Please forgive me, won't you? Namaste.